Lecture 7, Nietzsche's Critique of Historical Consciousness, on the Advantage and Disadvantage of History for Life.
In this lecture, we're going to engage with Friedrich Nietzsche's, one of his early offerings on history, called On the Advantage and Disadvantage of History for Life. It's a very brief text, but rather difficult in its own way. In it, Nietzsche focuses on an all too often ignored question, and a critical question which should be addressed. Namely, and it's the obvious intuitive question, why should we think about history? Why should we care about history? Why are we so obsessed with the past? What do we hope to learn from history? What is its value? Why all this talk of history? Now, given Nietzsche's biological and somewhat naturalistic bent towards things, this question demands analysis of the value of historical thought and knowledge for human life and human needs, and most especially for what he would consider the life instinct, the vital elan which leads to creativity, growth of the human spirit. So his question is, to what extent does history contribute to this? And to what extent might it not be a hindrance to such an instinct, to such drives? And it raises the fundamental possibility of a conflict between these two. Between, on the one hand, our knowledge of the past, between a knowledge of history and its meaning, and on the other, our human life needs, our drives, our instincts, and our will. And Nietzsche has no question as to where his loyalties reside. At the very opening of the text, he says, only so far as history serves life will we serve it. Which is to say, from a rational perspective, from a humane perspective, one cannot serve history to the extent where that begins to be a bar to life itself. Now, Nietzsche begins his analysis by contrasting the human condition, which he thinks is filled with memory and historical existence, with the eternal present of other herd mammals. And this may seem a silly contrast, but Nietzsche is being biologically correct. We are, after all, herd mammals, right? We're featherless bipeds that live in packs and hunt in packs and prey in packs and eat in packs. If that's the case, then it is a fair contrast to contrast us with other herd animals. The difference being, we do have a memory of our past, and we do have an awareness of our historical legacies, and they don't. And it's precisely because such animals, and he takes the example of the cow, which he uses quite often because cows are ruminators and are thus thoughtful animals, such animals always lack an awareness of their past or future. And they live in an eternal present without cares, right? There's a certain sort of blissful state that one can see in a cow grazing in a pasture. It's not concerned about where it came from. It's not concerned that it's going to wind up stakes. It doesn't know it. And I quote, only briefly concerned with their pleasure or displeasure, enthralled by the moment, and for that reason, neither melancholy nor bored. That is the great virtue, the happiness of the herd beast. It lives in the present. It's not concerned about its future. It's not bored with its legacies. It's not weary of its burdens. And for that reason, man envies the beast. We envy it its happiness. And we yearn to be free from our past. But, and again I quote, however far and fast he runs, the chain runs with him. We can't escape our memory. We can't escape our historical past. And it is a burden with which we carry. Now think, isn't it that which we envy in childhood? When we talk about the innocence of a child, the innocence of children, what is it that we refer to except to the fact that the children have not yet developed historical consciousness? They don't have a burden of a legacy of a past that they must carry like a ball and chain. And again, I quote, the virtue of childhood, which as yet has nothing past to deny, playing between the fences of past and future in blissful blindness. Okay, so that must serve as our initial point of contrast, our point of reflection, the distinction between an unhistorical existence of the other herd mammals and our own. Nietzsche notes that all life requires what he calls a horizon, or what we might call a limited field of action. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, let me give you some examples. If you were going to study nature as a physicist, it would be absurd to begin with the question of, let me understand nature as a whole. What's the nature of the universe? That's a question which is going to lead you to run in circles forever. You have to limit your horizon, your field of action, and say, look, I'm interested in a particular problem. I'm interested in, say, the rectilinear propagation of light and noticing the fact that light is refracted through different mediums, different ways. I want to figure out what the various values that one would put into, say, Snell's law, the law which determines how light is refracted through different mediums. That's an example of limiting your horizon, of giving yourself a horizon within which you can work creatively and fruitfully. Similarly, as an historian, to talk about the nature of all of history, everything that's ever happened, is a project which, if anyone gets through the first chapter of that book, will be remarkable. Where to begin? There's just too much. You have to limit yourself. Maybe do a study of the Renaissance, a history of painting, a history of the Roman Empire. Those are limited fields of action. Those are problems with a horizon. Well, the same thing is true of life. Our lives must, too, have horizons. Consider if you are part of a community and interested in perhaps improving that community in some way. How paralyzed would you be if you had to try to resolve all of the problems of the world? Every disease, every famine, every plague, every structural imbalance, every unfairness. Where would you begin? Nowhere. The fact is, without a horizon, your will, your desire, your ability to act is seized. It's seized by self-doubt. It's seized by insecurity, by an uncertainty of where to begin. And it's Nietzsche's contention that too much history, too large of a dose of an awareness of the human past, leads to dissolving that horizon, leads to an inability to mark off a limited field of action. As a creative being, man needs some history. There's no question of it. He needs some memory to fashion and refashion himself as man, as distinct from other herd mammals. But too much history, a surfeit of history, produces the German word Weltschmerz, a world weariness, a burden feeling for all of historical existence. And it leads to nausea, in the Sartrean sense of discontentedness with the human condition, and ennui, a sort of decadent lack of will, of appetite, of desire. We should never see history as an end in itself, according to Nietzsche, but as a means to something else, to life. That is the altar upon which all things must be sacrificed. History, I quote, so far as it serves life, serves an unhistorical power. It doesn't serve the past. It doesn't serve the future. It serves creativity. It serves will. When history works for us, it emboldens us to do great actions. It serves as an inspiration to creativity, to growth, to development. History should never be pursued for the sake of just collecting more knowledge about the past. Nietzsche, in accord with his biological thinking, believes that all of historical understanding emerges out of human needs. Now, he sees three distinct forms of historical interpretation, or three different sorts of historical accounts, three different types of history. And these are the monumental, the antiquarian, and the critical. Each of these three forms emerges and is derived from different historical human needs. They each fulfill different goals, different functions. And Nietzsche understands each of them as valuable and to be cherished. But when any one of those forms dominates at the expense of the others, the result is detrimental to life and is something to be feared is a source of danger. Okay, let's begin with monumental history. Monumental history serves the need of active and powerful individuals. Monumental history is the history of monumental events and monumental beings, great, inspiring events. Histories of famous military campaigns, most military histories of the Civil War, for example, are monumental histories. The tremendous integrity of Robert E. Lee, the fierce competitiveness of Stonewall Jackson, the brutal clarity of mind of Ulysses S. Grant, the utter ruthlessness and daring of William Tecumseh Sherman. Similarly, many great art histories are monumental histories. The universal genius of Leonardo da Vinci, the daring exploits of Michelangelo. So what monumental history serves is the human need to find models, to find teachers, for people who have the aspiration to greatness, to creativity, to producing monumental things themselves. And they can't find such teachers always in the present. The number of monumental figures in all of history is fairly small. So they need role models, they need teachers, they need sources of inspiration, and they look for that in the past. And that is the function that monumental history serves. The demand for monumental history, then, expresses something very positive, a faith in humanity, a faith such that, and I quote Nietzsche here, the great moments in the struggle of individuals form a chain in them, that in them the high points of humanity are linked throughout millennia, that what is highest in such a moment of the distant past be for me still alive, right, and great. So as a philosopher, he may well look back to Socrates, to Heraclitus, not as relics to be understood within their own context and times, but as symbols of greatness and of achievement, as inspirations to himself, that he could think in monumental terms of himself as a contemporary with them, as an inheritor to them in some way. Now, obviously, the benefit of such a monumental history is that it produces courage in us, the belief that such greatness is indeed achievable because it has been achieved before. We needn't limit ourselves to an academic painting style. We've seen revolutionary painters, Picasso's, Raphael's, Rembrandt's. We, therefore, can feel the courage to experiment, to try new things, vast things, great things. It induces a courage such that, and I quote again, the knowledge that the great which once existed was at least possible once and may well again be possible sometime. And we can think of examples of this sort of monumental history. Petrarch and the early figures of the Renaissance produced just such monumental histories of the classical Greeks and of the scholars of classical times, of the great philosophers and poets, precisely to inspire them to try to achieve such greatness again in the context of what they considered the mediocrity of scholasticism. And similarly, we can think of other examples in other disciplines where we draw on the inspiration of great historical predecessors. The early scientists of the Renaissance study the pre-Socratic physicists as a monumental inspiration to them about the possibility of speculating about nature without recourse to supernatural means, without recourse to religion. However, as with every mode of history and knowledge, it has disadvantages. First of all, the comparisons between the past and present that one finds in monumental history are always imprecise and generally ahistorical. They never take into account the reality of the context which produced that particular moment or that particular monumental figure. Monumental history is incapable of understanding the causes of events, particularly when such causes are ignoble or mundane. How can a monumental history account for the great victory, say, of Ulysses S. Grant, his steadfastness, when in fact part of that inspiration may have been his rather pathetic childhood, the fact that he was a perennial loser in anything he tried to do up to his life, and that when the blood started flowing seriously, he crawled inside of a bottle for a few days. Right? That tends to deflate somehow the monumental. And it's precisely those sorts of realities which become obscured in an understanding of the past in monumental terms. An example that we can have of monumental history, national and religious celebrations, right, are all monumental. And they always ignore the causes of the events celebrated. Okay? We celebrate the 4th of July as a great moment of independence. Do we mention the fact that the reason that that event occurred was because we didn't really want to pay any taxes? That we were taxed far less than any of the people in the British Empire that were not in North America, and yet we refused to pay those taxes for our own protection and defense? No, we don't. Similarly, our religious celebrations and rituals, when we celebrate, let us say, Easter, right, the Passion of Christ, do we point out that the reason that this really happened was because some guy sold Jesus for money? And that, in fact, Jesus didn't have the political support among the community of the Jews to protect him from crucifixion. Yet, in fact, he failed to organize his community sufficiently to be able to continue to preach. And another example, another problem. Monumental history tends to ignore vast portions of the past, portions that are either uninspiring or aren't monumental. An excellent example of this is Hegel's philosophy, which in many ways is monumental's philosophy of history. After China has produced its great contribution of showing that the one is free, it drops out of history. Apparently nothing happened in China after about the Shang Dynasty. Okay, that sort of violence to our historical knowledge is one of the drawbacks of monumental history. Okay. Now, the next mode is antiquarian history. Antiquarian history serves the need to preserve and admire, or what we may call the revering soul. Antiquarian history is a study of and a collection of antiquities, of old things, of things which somehow mark our origins and which we cherish as treasures. And what the antiquarian historian does then is preserve what has allowed for the growth of himself, of his nation, of his culture, of his city. And this serves life. Just as monumental history served life by producing models, this serves life by giving us a variety of traditions and institutions which have helped us in the past and teaching us to treasure and revere them. Now, on the plus side, this antiquarian history serves to create a we out of the inheritors of certain institutions and traditions. An antiquarian awareness of the Constitutional Convention serves to create a national identity for peoples whose ancestors may not have been in this country at the time, or may have been enslaved, or may not have been part of the civic community. But nonetheless, an awareness of those traditions, engaging in things like 4th of July celebrations, collecting genealogies, serves of our great founders, serves to give us a sense of our collective identity, to create a strong sense of community, because these are shared inheritances. Such reverence can have great value during times of trouble, when the society is threatened by possible disintegration or defection. And I quote, "Such reverence is of the highest value where it imbues modest, coarse, even wretched conditions in which a man or people live with a simple, touching feeling of pleasure and contentment." Think of what happens in a nation as it undergoes a famine and a hard time. The people must be sorely tempted to emigrate en masse. What keeps them at home is that antiquarian connection with their past, that sense that the old country holds something sacred to them, something valuable. And this serves life. It serves the life of the nation. It may serve the life of the people. Even if, take the case where there is not the possibility of emigration, at least it gives them some consolation, some salve, some hope, some belief that their condition is not as desperate as objective conditions might suggest. And he compares this to, and again I quote, the contentment of a tree with its roots, the happiness of knowing oneself not to be wholly arbitrary and accidental, but rather as growing out of the past as its air, flower, and fruit. And this is no small form or source of psychological satisfaction. Okay. However, again, it has downsides. While such antiquarian history may serve life, it certainly doesn't serve historical truth or pure knowledge. In the sense that such antiquarian history tends to always rip out of its context those antiquities. The wonderful founding fathers and their deliberations are always rooted out of the context of, well, we tried another constitution and it failed abysmally. And basically, most of these people own bonds in the U.S. government, which are not going to be paid under the old Articles of Confederation. So they create a new constitution in which they will be paid at rates which are extremely profitable. It also can hinder judgment in the sense that antiquarian history teaches us that whatever is old is to be venerated. Whatever has endured is valuable. And thus, the useful and the outdated are not distinguished. They're put together hand by hand. Nietzsche says, then you may well witness the repugnant spectacle of a blind lust for collecting, of a restless raking together of all that has once been. Consider the fascination with the stars and bars in the South. The holding on to that relic. Why? That's past. Slavery's done. The Civil War's over. It lost. You're not going to go back to those days. That's an outworn relic of a past, which is venerated simply because it's old. Don't know if it's good, don't know if it's bad, but it sure is old. Similarly, think of things like Jim Crow, caste structures in other countries. These are all relics of a past which only persist because of this antiquarian sort of history that venerates anything that's old and fails to distinguish between that which is useful, serves life, serves humanity, and that which stands in its way. And this brings up a third and critical point. Antiquarian history only understands how to preserve life, how to keep alive the things that have helped, but it doesn't know how to generate life. It only teaches us how to preserve what has been, but it never gives us any clue as to how to create what we need, how to create something new, how to build. Only the monumental can help us do that, can offer models and inspiration. Thus, the antiquarian historian, the antiquarian history, paralyzes the man of action and I quote, hinders the powerful resolve for new life, stops human creativity, and leaves it shackled to the dead hand of the past. All right, we now turn to the third form of history, critical history. And by this he means the developed scientific historiography of the 19th century. Right, a fully self-conscious, historicist awareness of the distinction between past and present. And it serves the need among humans to liberate us from the shackles of, for example, a conservatism born of mindless antiquarianism. Critical history teaches us how to criticize our past, how to criticize the elements of our society that are simply relics of an outdated epoch. The strategy of critical history generally is to drag something old and tired before the bar of judgment. It is interrogated and condemned in the interests of life and growth. I think of, in American history, C. Van Woodward's brilliant work, The Strange Career of Jim Crow, in which, during the height of segregation, he analyzed historically, in a critical way, how this institution of segregation in the South had emerged, its origins, showed its flawed nature, criticized it, judged it deficient, wanting, and condemned it to death. And it was a work that had a profound impact in policy circles. We can think of examples in the subcontinent of Asia where histories of caste serve to undermine the belief in such caste. These time-worn traditions which date back well before the time of Christ and are revered as part of a religious tradition are finally exposed to what they are. They're the results of the conquest by Indo-Aryans, of a native Dravidian population, which is subjugated, is perhaps separated on the basis of exploitation and perhaps protection from disease. And therefore, since those things have been transcended, there's no longer a need for them. What judges here, however, in a critical history, is not justice. What's judging is life, the need to move on, the need to grow, the need to develop. Okay? Now, critical history is a very tough sort of history, and it requires the strength to contemn time-worn pieties to the knife. It's not an easy thing. The most famous example, the beginning of critical history, is probably the higher criticism of the Bible, the critical history of biblical scholarship in the late 18th century, which required a very tough sort of spirit, because it for the first time showed that this text, which is revered as the center of our most revered religion, is in fact a compilation that can be dated to a particular moment, and is in fact comprised of a variety of different texts, edited by priestly scribes. Some text left out, some text put in, some text rewritten, some text changed. The words are different depending on where in Israel the texts were written. Similarly, the higher criticism of the New Testament shows there were hundreds of gospels circulating around. The bishops decided which ones were orthodox and put them in. The ones that they weren't, they burnt. That sort of critical history, then, unveiling that, is a very tough practice. It's also a dangerous practice, because everything can be subject to criticism. And everything that has a beginning, that has a history, has its share of injustice. And therefore, everything might be rightfully destroyed, including ourselves. A critical history of the emergence of the United States, by someone like the great colonial historian Edmund Morgan, argues, the rights of English, the rights of Americans, the expansion of democracy, was directly a result of slavery. Without slavery and the removal of any threat of class conflict, because the working class will now be exclusively enslaved and unpolitical, we can therefore extend rights, voting rights to everyone else. They're not a threat. So it's not an easy practice, critical history, and it has its dangers. Critical history places both the monumental and the antiquarian in its historical context. And it thus gives us a truly scientific understanding of what made these things possible. And unfortunately, this can be extremely deflationary. Hegel once had an expression that, when speaking of the subject of history, the great man, that never look too close at the great man critically and historically. He has to be looked at from a distance. And his expression was, no man is a gentleman to his valet de chambre. Right? Once you get too close to a great man and realize that he has bizarre bathroom habits or has strange dressing habits, the luster fades away. And so it is with all monumental events. They all have their embarrassing undersides. And the critical historian is always bringing these things to light. He's a sort of historical muckraker. Well, modern man, according to Nietzsche, has gone so far to demand that history be a science and thus place no limits on it as it relates to life. We are willing to sacrifice life in favor of historical, scientific understanding of the human past. The result, for Nietzsche, and I quote, is, historical knowledge floods in ever anew from inexhaustible springs, the alien and the disconnected throng about. Memory opens all its gates, and is still not opened wide enough. Nature makes a supreme effort to receive these alien guests, to order and to honor them, but these themselves are at war with each other. And it appears necessary to master and overcome them all, so as not oneself to perish in their strife. Gradually, it becomes second nature to get accustomed to such a disorderly, stormy, belligerent household. While at the same time, it is beyond question that this second nature is much weaker, much more troubled, and through less healthy than the first. An awareness of the contingency of historical events, of the wide varieties of phenomena that make up the world and the world's historical process, lead to nothing so much as confusion. There's too much to assimilate. Everything is seen in both its positive and negative features. Everything is placed in its context. And this leads to a certain confusion at first. And his point is, Historical consciousness leads you to not so much get confusion at first, but to get used to that as your regular state of affairs, where people are no longer certain of their opinions. They're no longer certain of what is right and wrong, of what they want to do in life. There are too many possibilities, too many options, too many sides to all of the issues. And that human nature that evolves from that state of uncertainty, he finds relatively weak, passive. It doesn't have the strong life instinct that a much more limited field of action, a much more limited horizon would. It lacks confidence. Okay, Nietzsche thinks that this surfeit, this overabundance of historical consciousness in the modern age results in five particular evils. First is an excessive contrast of inside and outside, and he claims that this is generated and the personality weakened thereby. Well, what does this mean? Modern man separates his internal sense of self from his external world. The external world is just too complicated and too confusing. Therefore, he becomes internally focused, trying to understand his own unique nature. That means that the world around him becomes a mere spectacle, something within which he is not a natural participant and he is not at ease. He becomes, and I quote, a spectator, merely enjoying himself and strolling around and brought to a condition which can hardly be altered for a moment, even by great wars and great revolutions. News of tragedies and ethnic cleansings abroad elicit from us a tisk-tisk. And isn't that unfortunate? Our souls are no longer moved. We're no longer profoundly affected by historical events because we're overcome by them. There's too many of them. We've learned to separate our own internal states from the world around us, to place that barrier of distance. This blur of events and information pushed into the brain leads man to become so relativistic as to question his own standards of judgment and retreat into mere historical understanding. Was the French Revolution a good thing? Too complex a question. I can explain to you perhaps why it occurred, some of its causes. But as for whether it's a good thing or not, well, who can say? It's too difficult. Well, if we can't say, who can? Do we expect the herd animals to speak? Do we expect God to come down and tell us? Only strong personalities, he claims, can endure history. The weak are completely extinguished by it. Only those with an exceptional sense of personality can learn to demand and insist on their own standards of judgment. The rest of us simply become overcome by all this knowledge. In short, we become sort of psychological wet noodles. All right, the second problem. Too much historical awareness makes an age think it's the most just. As we come to understand more and more about history, we come to think that we are the most fair-minded. We are the most reasonable. We are the most just. We understand how things have happened. We think our historical objectivity has its origins in a heightened desire and demand for justice. But justice is a hard virtue and requires a strong and fanatical hand. Justice cannot know compassion. It must enforce rules with an absolute rigidity. The modern man can recapitulate the themes of the historical past, but never with its original strength or its élan. And I quote, "The original note usually awoke great deeds, needs, terror. This one, the historical, lulls us to sleep and turns us into soft men of pleasure. It is as though the heroic symphony by Beethoven had been arranged for two flutes and reserved for the use of dreamy opium smokers. The actual motives of our historical objectivity aren't a desire for greatness, for a ruthless understanding of a scientific nature, but are simply curiosity, boredom, and a need to prattle and gossip. Most historical judgments are based on the idiotic, parochial, and, I quote, naive belief that just their age is right in all its popular opinions, and that to write in accordance with the times comes to the same things as being just. So we write about how finally there was progress from absolute monarchy and dictatorship to human freedom and equality. Great progress because we believe in human freedom and equality. But that doesn't mean that that's what's right. Nietzsche doesn't believe we're equal. He thinks democracy is a mediocre form of government. It produces mediocre people and a mediocre culture. It produces a culture of MTV. What we call justice is simply affirming the virtues that we live by, and that's the result of our excess of historical consciousness. I quote again, "The instincts of a people are impaired, and the maturing of the individual, no less than that of the whole, is prevented." This is because critical history destroys myths and delusions. Critical history teaches us that George Washington was not that great austere figure who refused to chop down a cherry tree. When he chopped down a cherry tree, refused to lie afterwards. He was really an ambitious middling planter who married a much older woman because she had a lot of property, and who was probably stiff and full of integrity because he had wooden teeth and they were very painful. That John Adams was not inspired by the greatest of principles. He was really a rather obese, pompous man who was full of ambition and vanity. Thomas Jefferson wasn't a great egalitarian fighter for freedom. Yeah, he wrote some interesting documents. He also had slaves, and he couldn't understand why they were so damn lazy and didn't work hard enough to help him pay off his gambling debts, or his debts for architecture, or his debts for whatever consumption he engaged in. Well, there's truth in all of those statements, but they destroy the myths and delusions and illusions which foster creativity, which foster inspiration. It's like telling a child immediately, you know, there is no Santa Claus, really. There's a certain point at which the child needs to know that. Needs to know that there is a Santa Claus, there is a tooth fairy. Yes, it's true, if you say your prayers and act like a good person, God's watching and you'll be rewarded for it. And it's true, bad people suffer. So this critical history, and again I quote, destroys illusions and destroys existing things and robs existing things of their atmosphere in which alone they can live. With certain creative and life-inspiring institutions and practices require an atmosphere of illusion around them, right? Could you imagine telling an artist who's trying to express himself that, gee, you know, you're really only playing out the possibilities of the form developed in the last 20 years. And it's all sort of out of point since the development of photography, if you're going to do realist painting. Or better yet, you know, gee, all of your painting really just expresses the various traumas you experienced as a child. And it's your juvenile wish to act out and, as Freud would say, spread feces on the wall, and as a result, express your juvenile inability to accept the reality of other people. These things may be true, they may not be true, but in any case, when stated, they destroy the atmosphere of awe and reverence within which that artist exists, which inspires him to go forward and think he's really creating something absolute and significant. Thus, for example, any history of Christianity, good critical history of Christianity, always proves the undoing of Christianity by dispelling the pietistic and superstitious atmosphere that surrounds it. Any good history of Christianity which points out, yes, Jesus thought he was the Messiah, and there was one right before him, and then another one before him, and yeah, they all claim to walk on water and do miracles. It was a pretty standard thing to find at the time. And the devil really does come from Zoroastrianism. His original name was Angra Mainyu. And the halo around the heads of saints actually comes from Mazdaism, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. By the time you're done with such an accurate history, pointing out that actually Paul was a businessman as well and refused to travel on the seas because he was afraid, once you start giving all of those details, you wind up an atheist. It destroys it because you destroy the illusions, that atmosphere of reverence which surrounded it. Monumental achievements, then. And even great men are cut down to size. Since, as Hegel said before, no man is a gentleman to his valet de chambre. Right? Everyone, when faced with critical history, can be reduced. An inspiring history like figure like Theodore Roosevelt, one of the great, energetic presidents of the 20th century, great innovator, turns out he was probably overcompensating for the fact that he was a very small and weak child and he was always picked on by bullies. So he tried to be tougher than thou. He was an example of Adler's theory of overcompensation. For an institution, or even a person to grow, it needs this sort of mystical atmosphere. This mystical atmosphere gives it self-confidence. It gives it an illusion that allows it to follow its life-creating instincts. when you point out all of the strange contingencies that must exist if some creative individual is, in fact, to achieve some success, that he's got to find a good agent, the market's got to be correct, if the business cycle's in the wrong cycle, he's not going to have any success, is going to lead that person to turn into an accountant rather than a painter. It needs to have that mythic atmosphere that there is a universal brotherhood of the great painters, that Rembrandt, in a way, was alive in the mind of Picasso, and Raphael in the mind of Rembrandt. It is precisely this, though, that the historical consciousness destroys in favor of a knowledge which is sterile. One blinds some birds to make them sing more beautifully. I do not believe that today's men sing more beautifully than their grandfathers, but I do know that they are blinded early. By the means, the vile means used to blind them is too much too bright, much too sudden, much too changeable light. The young man is whipped through all millennia. Youths who understand nothing of war, of diplomatic action, of commercial policy are deemed worthy of being introduced to political history. But just as the young man runs through history, so we moderns run through art galleries. So we listen to concerts. Only may we feel that this sounds different from that, this makes a different impression from that, increasingly to lose this sense of surprise, no longer to be excessively astonished by anything. Finally, to tolerate everything. That is what we call historical sense, historical culture. Okay. The fourth problem that Nietzsche finds with historical consciousness is that we come to see ourselves as we understand more and more of the past. And we saw this with Hegel as latecomers, as epigeny, as the last men at the end of history. We are the result of a vast sweep of history in which all great things have occurred so that we should have the historical awareness of being a consequence, a result. And this wisdom means that we are, in a sense, old men. The youth of the creativity of our species is behind us. We stand back and reflect on what has happened. We have no creativity left. There are no new great projects ahead of us. All that is left for us is to understand what we have done. Historical education, quote, really is a kind of inborn gray-headedness. And those who bear its mark from childhood on surely must attain the instinctive belief in the old age of mankind. Historical awareness tends to make us believe that we have gone about as far as we can go. There's nothing new under the sun. And this leads us to our fifth problem, that we become ironic and indeed cynical, even about ourselves. That is because our scientific history teaches us that previous creative periods were not burdened with our historistic self-awareness as last men, as the men who have worn out their spirit and have nothing left but reflection on their past. And the historian himself must be aware that the reason other peoples were creative was because they didn't have that burden. They didn't have that awareness. So we come to be ironic even about our own historical understanding, seeing as it is absent in all creative epics. This becomes cynical with Hegelianism, which Nietzsche detested. Because with Hegelianism, we find that whatever happens to win in the process of history is proclaimed to be ordained by the world spirit as necessary. So we become so cynical as to say, whatever has won in history was right, because the rational is the real and the real is the rational. What could be more cynical than that? That is fawning upon the victors. That is saying, whoever comes out on top, we will bow before you and give you the imprimatur of historical evolution. We thus get on our knees with every authority because it has succeeded in becoming an authority. Okay, what we have found with Nietzsche then is that our excess of history, our surfeit of history, has destroyed our plastic ability to grow and change. Nietzsche thinks that the antidotes are the poisons of the unhistorical and the superhistorical. Unhistorical is simply the ability to forget, to leave the past to itself and charge into the future with a naive belief and confidence in possibilities. The enemy of this forgetting is science, which is always a horizon-creating phenomenon. Forgetting is the horizon-creating phenomenon. Science would eliminate all boundaries and throws man into an endless, unlimited, light wave sea of known becoming. Now, the super-historical is the realm of the stable and the eternal. It's the positing of great ideals and eternal verities. It is stable, and it is being without becoming. It is the realm of art and religion, of timeless essence and the universal. And it is the enemy of science. A history that served life with us fuse the unhistorical and the superhistorical. Unlike science, it would eschew the claim to object of truth in the sense of univocal interpretation, the one correct account, and the induction of general laws. General laws of history would be incredibly dull and trivial, Nietzsche says, if we could discover them. They probably have to do with diet. And Nietzsche thinks that history is always perspectival. It's always a question of your interests, of the perspective you come from, of your goals. Rather, a history that served life would be like art, in creating a unity and thematic coherence which exemplifies the general in the particular and the profound in the simple. It would allow us to forget what needs to be forgotten, i.e., the suffering and injustices of little men, of the average person. And let us focus on the great man of the past as an inspiration for the production of greatness ourselves, so that we shall not be a pigony and the last men. Such a history might be self-consciously mythopoetic or critical, with an eye towards the practical goal of life and health. And I want to end by suggesting examples. Examples of the former, of a mythopoetic history, might be Thus Spake Zarathustra by Nietzsche, or Ecce Homo, his own mythopoetic autobiography. An example of the latter, a critical history, would be The Genealogy of Morals, a scientific analysis of the beginning of our moral notions of good and evil, good and bad. Or The Birth of Tragedy, philological research into the fusion of Dionysic and Apollonian modes in Attic tragedy. All four of these histories are at the same time as critical, antiquarian, and monumental. Thus, Nietzsche himself, as an historian, and most of his works take the form of history, never practices one history at the expense of the other, but all in the service of life.